Yes, this will be our third and final commentary on insurable interest. We're going to cover insurable interest between parents and children with siblings, stepchildren, and foster parents. We're going to talk about insurable interest issues with respect to grandparents, aunts and uncles, and other relatives. And then we'll cover commercial relationships. We'll look at insurable interest between partners and partnerships, officers and shareholders, managers and directors, persons outside the business, and we'll conclude with rank-and-file employees and the lessons from the Coley cases and the new EOLI employer-owned life insurance code section 101J rules. So let's start with parents and children. And the general rule here is, with respect to insurance on the lives of parents by children or on the lives of children by parents, the general rule is that the natural affinity between those relationships is sufficient to cause an insurable interest, to create an insurable interest. Why? Well, because there's a natural bond between parents and children, or children and children and parents. There's a closeness. And the courts look at this as a very remote chance that a child would apply for a policy on the life of a parent with an intent to murder his or her parents for the proceeds and vice versa. Now, obviously, that's not a sure thing, but that's the general rule of law with respect to insurable interest. The same applies, believe it or not, even if a child is an adult and even if a child is not financially dependent on his or her parent or parents. Now, there is an exception when we talk about parents and children. And that exception is that if you have, and this is more and more common, where a child lives with one parent but not with the other, the court may say, we want you to show us some evidence of pecuniary interest. What interest do you have in the continuing life of your parent before we allow you to buy insurance on the life of a parent with whom you do not live?
Steve, how do you reconcile that with the last thing you just said, that adult kids are, you know, can buy insurance on their parents, and certainly in most of those situations there won't be any financial dependency? So how do those two things work?
Well, it's still the natural bond, the closeness. And I think the bottom line is there's a remote chance that one is going to buy a policy on the other with the intent to murder for the proceeds. And I'm going to come to the fact that I might as well come to it right now, and that is the general rule assumes that the knowledge and consent of the insured is present. And so if there is knowledge and consent, generally, the courts feel that's sufficient. Now, of course, knowledge and consent is almost always required, with the exception of relatively young children. So hopefully that answers your question, Randy. There is, again, we're looking at something that varies a little bit from state to state, and what I'm giving you, of course, is not an overall absolute, but pretty much what I feel and think and have taken away from my study of literally thousands of cases involving insurable interest.
Steve, I got a question about, as a lot of our listeners know, I have a young man who lives with my wife and I. We haven't formally adopted him, but he lives in our home as one of our sons. How does the law handle a situation like that?
Well, if it rises to the level of what's called loco parentis, often courts will find, and insurance companies will find, insurable interest, even if there is no kinship, if a person assumes the position of a parent. Now, I don't know whether your situation rises to that level, but certainly when that child is financially dependent on you, has an expectation that as long as you live, you will take care of him, then he or she has some kind of, and the courts stretch for this. Insurable interest is not something the courts go out of their way to say there isn't any. To the contrary, courts will go out of their way if there's some kind of valid, demonstrable reason. The courts will go out of their way to grant insurable interest, to say that there is insurable interest. So, again, if you are in a position where you are assuming the financial and moral obligations of a parent, then it's likely the court will say there is insurable interest. Let's talk about siblings, brothers. Do my brothers, Gary and Gene, do they have an insurable interest in my life? Well, for many years, the courts would say, no, they don't. But the trend is to find an insurable interest in the natural affection of close relatives.
I haven't talked to my brother for 3 years. I think that there's some lacking natural affection there.
Well, again, the courts are going to look at this on an individual basis. There is no hard and fast rule. Certainly, most states don't have statutes that specifically say brothers automatically or brothers and sisters automatically have an insurable interest in each other's lives. So what I'm saying is the trend is to bend over backwards to find insurable interest, but there's no hard and fast rule. And certainly, if the facts show that you haven't talked to your brother in 3 years, then there will be no insurable interest. Again, the courts are going to look at the totality of the situation. Sibling relationship will be enough in general if there is that relationship, but again, the courts will draw a line if they find there was no good faith, you hadn't talked to your brother in 3 years, or you bought the policy just to speculate on your brother's life. You're hoping he dies.
And I guess the fact that the insured consents is going to go a long way towards what the court will find. In the absence of a consent, I doubt that the court would allow that, correct?
I totally agree. And some courts in some states are still demanding evidence of pecuniary interest. Show us, Randy, why you would lose if your brother were to die, and show us how you gain if your brother continues to live. And so, as you say, courts always require the consent, and more importantly, the overlay of all life insurance is good faith, that there has some relationship and there is good faith between the parties, that you're not pulling one over on the courts or on the insurance company. And again, I get back to the point I make over and over again with this stranger on life insurance, that you don't have the good faith, you don't have the nexus, you don't have the relationship that you have here.
Problem so, is proof, though, Steve.
It is proof. And again, if it's the further away you go from a child and a parent or a husband and a wife, the further away you go, the more demonstrable evidence you must have of that nexus and that relationship and the desire to for that person to live rather than to die. Let's move to stepchildren and foster parents. The general rule here is just the opposite. The general rule, most courts will say that the mere existence of the fact that you have a stepchild, or let me get back to your case, perhaps you take this child in as a foster parent. The mere existence of a relationship will not be sufficient. However, a relationship, a longer-term relationship, plus a pecuniary relationship, in other words, this child for the last 4 years, 5 years, 10 years, has depended on you for food, clothing, and shelter. And that's, let me tick off some of the things, since you brought it up. Let me tick off some of the things the court is going to look at. Is there debt between the parties? What is the financial dependency between the parties? What kind of financial responsibility have you and your wife assumed vis-a-vis this young person? Does she have an expectation of benefit from your continued life? Is she or he dependent on you for support? How much? Are there enforceable claims between the two of you? How much would this person lose if you were to die, if your wife were to die? Have you assumed a strong moral obligation? So what the courts look at is a long-term relationship coupled with deep personal interaction. And the more these things you can prove that you can show, the more likely the courts will say, yes, there was insurable interest. Let's move to grandparents and grandchildren. Again, the general rule is the same. The relationship alone will not support insurable interest. But again, there's an exception, and that exception would apply if a young child went to live with his grandparent because his mother abandoned him, his father abandoned him. So if there is provable dependency, if there is provable support, if there is provable, demonstrable pecuniary interest, then you have, to that degree at least, insurable interest.
Steve, I'm going to put you on the hot spot because I just had a case come across my desk this past week where a grandson was applying as the owner and beneficiary of policy on the grandparent. And when we asked about the case, we were told that that he was inheriting under the will, and that in fact he had been named as the executor under this insured estate, and that and therefore that was where the insurable interest was. When we looked at the state law, there really wasn't much one way or the other to help me to make a determination if there was or was not an insurable interest in that situation. Obviously, the insured had consented to the contract. What is your thought in that kind of effect?
My guess is the court will probably go for it. My guess is the court will probably find. Now, that's not to say the insurance company is going to fall.
Well, I'm glad you said what you did, because I decided it looked like one to me, but I got to tell you, I just kind of took a stab in the dark.
Well, again, and I think the court is going to look and say, well, we have a signature here of the grandparent, but do we have informed consent? Was the grandparent competent? I think they're going to look at the whole situation.
Yeah.
So, it's not a slam dunk.
These things are hard.
Certainly the part about being named an executor shows trust, but it doesn't show the financial nexus, the pecuniary interest. The part about being named as a beneficiary of the estate, that gets a little closer. I would be much more happy if you said, well, there's some dependency here, there's some support. Grandparent buys these kids. But I think the courts are going to look at what is the relationship? Does this kid visit his grandparents all the time? They're going to look at a lot more things. So it's not a slam dunk in either direction.
Steve, the other thing that we see all the time are aunts and uncles. We see so often where somebody wants to insure an aunt or an uncle, or there's going to be what we see a lot of times is the second to die contract. So we'll see a contract on mom and her sister. What do you think about those structures?
I think the same general rule applies, and that is affinity alone will not be sufficient to support insurable interest. The mere fact that you're my aunt or my uncle, or I'm your niece or your nephew, doesn't allow you to buy insurance on my life or me to buy insurance on your life. We need to show, if you want to buy insurance, you've got to show some kind of pecuniary advantage from Uncle, Mother, Aunt Henrietta continuing to live, or some expectancy of a benefit from that continued life. The longer they live, the more they give me gifts every year. They use their annual exclusion and give me gifts. And I happen to have an aunt, my uncle recently died, but they would take care of a cousin of mine. They would send him money all the time. He did have, at least to some extent. Now, again, one of the things we started with is insurable interest is not an unlimited concept. It's not a yes or no. When the switch is pushed, you have unlimited insurable interest. That only occurs with respect to insurable interest on your own life. So
I think that's consistent with what our informal rule has been around here. When I see those aunts and uncle kind of a case situation, I always dive into those, and I want to be sure that we have representations and some facts that that there is some sort of a relationship, such that the insured has no family of his or her own, for instance, or there's some kind of a special relationship. So we just don't, as a matter of fact, issue those. We really look into the facts and try to make some kind of a decision based upon all the circumstances.
I think in my uncle's case, where he and my aunt were giving this particular nephew money each year, year after year, and the kid would get in financial trouble and they would give him some more, I think you can easily justify a policy on their lives. However, the question is how large a policy, and I think that's a question of reason.
I think one thing that our listeners can learn from this is that cover letters are important. I don't know how often I preach that, but cover letters are always key. But in this fact pattern, when you deal with these kinds of atypical family arrangements, the more that you can tell the insurance company about the relationship, the more chance you have of the policy being issued and less chance you have of a court finding a lack of an insurable interest.
I think that's a very, very good practical point. And by the way, these same rules apply to in-laws. The general rule is affinity will not be sufficient to support insurable interest. The same thing applies between cousins. Affinity will not be sufficient to support insurable interest. So let me lump all these further generation relatives and say that the general rule is, you're not close enough. The law just doesn't trust those relationships unless you can prove some kind of, and again, what Randy is saying is a practical matter, you've got to prove it. Certainly in court, you've got to prove it. Now, what if one relative says, I will take care of you for as long as you live, and puts it in writing? Well, that may be, and a lot of courts will find, most courts will find, as a matter of fact, that an agreement to support a relative, and if I agree to support my aunt or my uncle, and I put it in writing, or I in fact have been doing it year after year after year, supporting some other relative, then they have insurable interest on my life. Most courts will go along with that. But let me move from relatives to commercial relationships, because I think that a lot of your cases, Randy, a lot of the cases I've seen, not only with your company, the John Hancock, but with the many other companies I've worked with over the years, the tougher cases are where commercial relationships are involved. And here, what must be proven is a substantial economic interest in the continuing life of the insured or a demonstrable loss at the insured's death.
So partnership created by investors with the insured as a partner with no other relationship other than the joint venture into the life insurance contract,
interest is not enough. And I'm going to come back to that when we talk about partnerships and partners, but let me stress it right now. The partnership relationship, the fact, and I'll say the same thing about corporate relationship, the mere fact that you and I are legal partners, or the mere fact, Randy, that you and I are commercial partners in a corporation, an S corporation, a C corporation, doesn't matter. That relationship alone, that legal relationship alone, is not sufficient to provide insurable interest. What is necessary is a real and provable, here are the key words, pecuniary nexus.
Is that true even if the insured consents?
Even if the insured consents, the mere fact that I'm stupid enough to write my name down as insured or proposed insured is not enough to give you insurable interest in my life.
Because I've had people argue that point with me. They've said in states where you have an unlimited insurable interest on your life that a structure like the one I just described to you creates an insurable interest because, in essence, the insured has exercised his or her right to the unlimited insurable interest, and an insured can name whoever they want as a beneficiary. So, therefore, they would argue you're incorrect.
Well, they can argue all they want, but I'm here to tell you that the mere legal relationship is not sufficient. It just won't work. And what you're really saying to me is, you and I have entered into a wagering agreement.
Sounds like it to
me. Now, it is true that I can take out a policy and I can name whoever I want, whether or not that beneficiary has insurable interest in my life, because the presumption is I would not name somebody who will be betting on my life or name somebody who will be intending to kill me. That's very different from two individuals who happen to be in business with each other, but we have no financial nexus. Now, let's talk about partners and partnerships since you bring that up. First of all, let me just throw out that there are a lot of advantages in having life insurance in a family limited partnership or any other kind of partnership. They're much more flexible than trusts. Partnerships, you can amend them really easily. You can dissolve a partnership. You can liquidate it very quickly and with relatively benign tax results. The client can control to a great extent the terms of the partnership without causing 100% of the proceeds to be includable. There are a lot of advantages of life insurance on the lives of either partners or life insurance owned on the partners' lives by the partnership.
Someday we'll have to have you back to talk about the 2036 and 2042 issues with that one, but we'll skip that one for today.
There are, of course, issues, but let me just say that we're talking about insurable interest, and the general rule is that the partnership relationship per se will not be sufficient, is not sufficient to provide insurable interest. Now, what do you need? Well, insurable interest has got to be found in circumstances which arise out of or occur by reason of the partnership. Okay, be more specific. Well, you must demonstrate the same thing we've been talking about all along, a pecuniary interest in the continued life of the insured. I have to gain by Randy's continued life, or if he dies, I'm going to lose my shirt. I've got to be able to show to buy insurance on your life, Randy, a reasonable expectation that the longer you live, the more money I'll make or the better off financially I will be.
Now, nobody can insure me, Steve.
Do I have to show the size of that? Do I have to prove that I actually will lose X dollars? No. As long as I can reasonably show that I will gain financially by your continued life, that's sufficient for most courts. Now let me give you even more specific. The courts are going to look at, did you and I throw in capital together? Is there indebtedness to the partnership? Do you owe the partnership money? What kind of skills are you adding to the partnership? What kind of business experience do you have? What kind of abilities do you add to the partnership? All those things, the more skills, the more acumen, the more ability, the more experience, the more business contacts you have, the more you owe the partnership or me personally, all these things, the courts are going to say, okay, those are the nexus that we're looking for. That's the pecuniary nexus that's required. But absent those things, we don't have it. It's not there. The insurable interest is not there. So that's the bottom line, and the same thing applies in a corporate setting as it does in a partnership setting.
About tax exempts? How about charities, Steve?
Pardon?
How about tax-exempt orgs?
Even with tax-exempt orgs, the same thing applies. Is there something that you've added to the business or added to I'm very active in United Cerebral Palsy, and there's a guy named Steve who's the president of the organization. And the United Cerebral Palsy of Philadelphia can buy insurance on his life if and to the extent that United Cerebral Palsy will lose if he were to die and has to gain if he lives. And so he happens to be a tremendous asset, an unusually wonderful person who lots of people are attracted to and bring money to the organization. And so, therefore, to some extent, there is an insurable interest.
Again, facts and circumstances, put it in the cover letter. It's going to depend upon, at least here, how we look at those, Steve, is we look at how much does the individual give, what does the individual do, if they fundraise, what kind of, who do they work with, what do they bring in, if they're active. What role do they play in it? We look at all those facts and essentially try to come up with some sensible estimate for what value do they have, what would each charity lose by their death.
Yes, and it is a very viable sale. A sale of life insurance that will be owned by and payable to the charity is a very viable sale. Even, I'm going to anticipate a question, even if the charity says, we want to own this. We want to be the beneficiaries. But how do we pay the premiums? Well, we have to finance them. Well, I'm not for financing of charitable owned life insurance. Why not? Well, because when you go through all the numbers, you find that the charity doesn't end up with that much. On the other hand, if it's a donor that's financing it, because the donor's got all his money tied up, but he wants to do something wonderful for the charity, and the charity's the owner and the charity's the beneficiary, I have no problem at all with that. But the point is there is insurable interest in the set of facts that you've just given us, where over and over again, Randy Zipse's contributed year after year. He's on the board of trustees. He attracts a lot of donors, and his death would cause a tremendous financial loss. Speaking of death, when does insurable interest die? And the answer is it doesn't die. It sometimes gets severed by facts and circumstances. But if a partnership, and I'm getting back to the partnership aspect here, if a partnership dissolves, does that mean that the beneficiary can't receive the proceeds? And the answer is no. A dissolution does not generally prevent the lawful receipt of proceeds, but it may mean, if the relationship dissolves, that the facts and circumstances that lent themselves to insurable interest are no longer there, so you can't buy more insurance.
Steve, that gets to a question that comes up an awful lot, is in that kind of a fact pattern where you had a policy that was issued with a legitimate insurable interest, but at this point there isn't one, say because of the partnership or a shareholder, co-shareholder relationship is gone, but there's a policy in place and they want to exchange it. Let's say they're not even going to increase the face amount, but they just want to go, say, from a guaranteed to a non-guaranteed or a variable to a fixed. What is your thought on the ability to issue that new contract?
I don't think the company has any problem vis-a-vis insurable interest.
You believe that it carries over from the one that was already in place?
Absolutely. My feeling is that insurable interest was there. It does. Again, we're not really talking about insurable interest at this point, because insurable interest in most situations and most states and most courts, you only have to prove it at the time the policy was issued.
Would you feel otherwise if they were increasing the face amount?
Well, if they were increasing the face amount, yes, then you have a different situation entirely. A mere exchange is one thing, but if you're increasing the proceeds, then to the extent of the increase in the insurance, then you're looking at a new situation.
Makes sense.
Officers, shareholders, managers, and directors, let's talk about them. Again, I think our listeners know what the answer is going to be. Only if the business success or the potential for profit depends on the continued life and or would suffer substantial economic loss at death do we have insurable interest. But if we have a person who, an officer, a shareholder, a manager, even an outside director, upon whom the success of our business, the financial success of our business depends, or our potential for extra profit depends, then to that extent we have insurable interest. And again, the courts are going to look at, you know, how much capital did he or she contribute? Did he or she owe the business money? What about the skills of that person? What was the management ability? What was the experience? What were the business contacts? And by the way, I think you can find insurable interest even on somebody who isn't even working in your business. For example, a key supplier. Even persons outside the business may have insurable interest in somebody in your business, in a key employee in your business. For example, say it's you're running a business, Randy, and I have loaned money to the business. I'm not an officer. I'm not a shareholder. I have no relationship with the business except as a creditor. But I have insurable interest on your life because my investment might go down the tubes at your death, and I certainly won't see it unless you continue to live. So to that extent, I have insurable interest.
Steve, here's one that I declined several years ago. Tell me if you think I made the right or wrong call. We had a situation where we had a business owner who sold his wares through a relatively small distribution force. There were just a couple of business owners who sold what he made, and he felt that those limited distribution sources were so valuable to him that if they died, that his business would be harmed, and therefore he felt that he had an terminal interest in the people who sold what he manufactured.
I would concur.
Well, I guess I got that one wrong.
Well, there is no right or wrong here because, again, each case is going to be looked at individually, but the more he depends, in fact, there are cases almost right on point. There are cases, cattle situation where a guy, cattle and grain, and one guy was a broker and he dealt with somebody else. If you're dependent on somebody else that's supplying you with thread or with, and that person's business fails because he dies, source of revenue dries up. So, again, to that extent, you have some insurable interest. Well, let's talk about the really tough thing right now, which is rank-and-file employees. Now, many states have specific enabling laws that say a business has insurable interest on the life of its employees, even rank-and-file employees. However, many states, with all the Coley cases, all the adverse publicity that Coley cases got in the late 80s and 90s, some states have backed off that. In fact, they've gone the exact opposite way. And what has happened because of the adverse publicity in the Coley situations, Congress snuck what I call a backdoor insurable interest law. And that backdoor insurable interest law is Code Section 101J. I call EOLI, employer-owned life insurance. And let me just back off the 101J for a second and talk about Coley cases and what they did, and then I'll come right back into the EOLI law. All the Coley cases, Walmart, and some of the other cases that Camelot, they all ended up with claims by widows and estates of insured rank-and-file employees. And every one of them said, Mr. Employer, you never had insurable interest. Therefore, you shouldn't have bought, and you were unjustly enriched by the policy on my husband's life. And the courts agreed with many of these widows and many of these estates and awarded them the money. The point I'm trying to make here is insurable interest is no longer merely an insurer's argument that we're not going to pay because there was no insurable interest. Insurable interest has now become a whole new legal theory. And insurable interest may be, as it was in Walmart and some other cases, an argument by widows and by estates for monetary damages. In fact, what I'm thinking is that judges may equate insurable interest charges with, or lack of insurable interest, with a form of fraud, with a form of misrepresentation, and certainly with the taint of a deceptive practice. If there was no insurable interest, all of these things, the taint of all these things, even if they're not called fraud or misrepresentation or a deceptive practice, certainly there is that taint, that smell, that feel. And so the courts have been saying that an employer who has no insurable interest should not get the proceeds, and the death benefit should go to the insurer's estate. Well, this is the background upon which Code Section 101J occurs. Lo and behold, in an act called the Pension Protection Act, having nothing to do with insurable interest and nothing to do with life insurance, we get the Pension Protection Act of 2006, incredibly important legislation on employer-owned life insurance. This legislation, which is now in effect, impacts on large employers and small employers. When I say small employers, I'm talking about an employer, a single employer, and a single employee. They are covered.
Steve, I think it goes a lot farther than almost all of our listeners probably have thought about. I think you have situations whereby you have a lot of people might consider it to be a family limited partnership or a family LLC where there's an insurance contract being bought on the patriarch or the matriarch that might be subject to something like that. I think buy sell arrangements are subject to it.
Let me come back to those related party rules in just a second, but let's just cover the basics here. Employer-owned life insurance. The basics are that there are four elements to this new law. And the four elements are, number one, notice and consent. Notice and consent, that's number one. Number two, eligibility screening. Number three, there is now a reporting element. And number four, there is now a record-keeping element.
Steve, I hate to continue to interrupt you, but again, I think that I need to point out on the notice and consent, most people don't understand that that has to be done before the policy is issued or it's not effective. And
yes,
I don't believe that most employers realize it's the employer obligation, and the insurance company has no obligation. By statute, it's an obligation of the employer, and it has to be before issuance.
Yes, and let me say something you may or may not like to hear, and that is I think that a smart insurance company will demand as part of the application and refuse to accept or go further with an application unless it has a written notice and the appropriate consent. But you're absolutely right. The notice and consent, which must be in the hands of the employer before the coverage is issued, must specify the maximum coverage, and it must specify that we can keep this coverage after you retire. It's got to say certain things, and it's got to be in writing, and it's got to be back in the employer's hands, as Randy's pointed out, before the coverage is issued. Otherwise, you're in deep trouble. Now, let me talk about the deep trouble, and then we'll get into the rules. This new law has revolutionized the way life insurance is taxed. To some, it may be horrifying. And here's the penalty. The penalty for not complying with these rules is very simple, and that is what once was previously tax-exempt life insurance, income tax-free, now becomes ordinary income. If you do not meet the notice and consent and the further rules that I'm about to talk about, the proceeds, when they're paid to the employer, however the word employer is defined, the proceeds are going to be ordinary income except to the extent of the premiums paid. So you have to do two things to keep the proceeds income tax free. Otherwise, the general rule is proceeds of employer-owned life insurance will be ordinary income taxable to the employer upon receipt.
Steve, isn't that interesting? For one totally unrelated issue, I get people that argue with me all the time that insurance contracts bought as investments should be subject to capital gains. I think it's kind of interesting that the one statute we finally have specifically says it's ordinary income.
It's very clear. It's very clear that it will be ordinary income unless two things happen. One is that the notice and consent rules are met, and notice I say and, not or, and the insured must be a member of an accepted class, and I'm going to give you those accepted classes right now. So two things have got to happen for the proceeds to be tax-free. Otherwise, they're going to be ordinary income. Number one, notice and consent rules must be met. I'll cover them in a minute. And number two, the insured must be a member of the accepted class. Now, again, the notice and consent rules, you must in writing notify the employee. The employee must sign in writing. There must be consent. You must tell the employee in that writing, here's the maximum amount of coverage we can place on your life. And number two, we may keep this insurance after you retire. And as Randy's pointed out, and I'm going to point out a third time, you must have that back in the employer's hands before the coverage is issued. My suggestion is that the insurance company take that document. A copy should be in the attorney's hands, a copy should be in the employer's hands, and a permanent copy should be in the insurer's hands, and a smart insurance company will file these things. Employers die, employers get replaced, they lose things, they get in floods, the buildings burn down, attorneys die, insurance companies live forever. So as a practical matter, that's my suggestion. Now, here are the protected classes. You must meet the notice and consent rules and fall within a protected class. Who's in a protected class? Well, number one, if you were an employee within 12 months before your death, you will be in a protected class. But if you retired 5 years ago and you're a rank-and-file employee, you're not going to make it under the that protected class category. The second protected class category is if you were, if the insured was, at the time the policy was issued, if you were a director of the corporation, if you were a 5% or greater owner of the business, if you were high, but I said corporation, this goes beyond corporate law into partnerships. Again, it's employer-owned life insurance. It doesn't say anything about corporate or versus partnership. So employer-owned life insurance, if you at the time a director, a 5% or greater owner, you are highly compensated. What does that mean? You earned over $95,000 a year, or you were among the five highest paid officers, or your salary was among the highest 35%, then you would fall into a second protected class. Again, director, 5% or greater owner, highly compensated, meaning over $95,000 a year, five highest paid officers, or highest 35% of all employees, that would make you in the second class. The third protected class, which really doesn't make a lot of sense for these rules, but if the insurance is paid to a member of the insured's family, or if the insurance is paid to a trust that benefits a member of the insured's family, or if it's paid to the estate of the insured, but that's not really what we're talking about here, but they are all protected classes. There's one more protected class that is, I think, often misunderstood, and that is you're in a protected class if the insurance is used to purchase equity in the employer. Now, here's the rest of it, and you got to have the rest of it. If the insurance is used to purchase equity in the employer from a family member, a beneficiary of the insured, a trust of the insured, or the insured's estate, so that does not include, it does not protect insurance used by me to buy insurance on Randy's life. That does not put us in a protected class. Now, we may be in a protected class for another reason, but you don't fall within this protected class unless it's used to buy equity in the employer from a family member, beneficiary, trust, or estate. Randy, have any questions or want to throw out any comments at this point?
Well, I just, I guess, Steve, I'd like to just point out the same thing as you have, is that, you know, this is a very misunderstood rule. I see a lot of situations where I'm concerned if all the rules are being followed, and I think our producers need to make a point to learn these rules.
Absolutely.
I hear what you say about, you know, it's wise and smart to have the insurance company request and collect this info. We do that if it's a typical corporate-owned insurance contract, because in those situations we know it's going to be subject to these rules. But in a retail contract where it's being underwritten and issued through our retail operation as opposed through the COLI operation, it's very hard for us to know if it's going to be a case subject to this or not, because so many cases are underwritten informally without even knowing who the owner or the beneficiary will be until late in the game. Or even if we know who the owner is, we have a name, we know it's, you know, it's a partnership, or we know it's a trust, or we know something of, you know, we know it's going to be, well, Steve Lineberg's going to own a policy on Randy's life, but we don't know what those relationships are. So it's very hard, oftentimes, in fact, impossible for us to know if we're in a situation where it's required, that these rules be done. So what we've done is we've simply put a notice in the illustration system from when somebody runs an illustration that tells them that, you know, if this is going to be owned by an employer, you'd better be sure that you understand these new rules and that, you follow them, because it's the employer's obligation to be sure that compliance is done.
Yeah, and he's going to be angry, but the problem is there's no way the typical employer will know this rule. There's no way the typical attorney or accountant will know this rule. So they're really looking to the insurance agent or broker to know this rule. Let me conclude, because we're running tight on time, but let me just talk about the tax reporting that's required. Any employer who buys a policy after the magic date, and the magic date, the date of enactment here, is August the 17th, 2006. In other words, we're into it now. We're already into it. Any policy purchased by whoever is considered an employer, payable to that employer, from the date of August, starting with the date of enactment, August 17, 2006, is not only required to meet the rules we talked about, but there's tax reporting required. Employers are required to file annual returns showing information about employees and confirming that they have the notice and consent and who is covered and who's not covered. And that's now. That is every taxable year going forward. So it's been in effect since August 17, 2006.
Steve, I'm going to ask you one bad question on grandfathering because it's one I get all the time. What happens in a corporate-owned life insurance situation where the employer is owning a contract on an employee who's no longer there, and the COLI producer is going to move the entire block, which is what is ordinarily done in that kind of a situation, and they're 1035 exchanging contracts that are on lives that are currently employed and lives that are no longer employed? What is your feeling on the application of the Act to that?
The answers are not clear at this point. Certainly, if there is a material change, 1035 exchanges, let's say, are grandfathered. But, and there's a big but, if there is a material change in the policy.
Like an increase in face.
Like an increase in face amount, I think that's a clear material change, then there is no grandfathering, and you may have killed your grandfathering. The law is not clear enough for us to give a definitive answer. There is no definition at this point of material change. So you need to be very, very careful about any change you make to a contract which was in effect before August 17, 2006. Now, I'm just going to point a few things out very quickly, and we've got to wrap this up. Number one, don't forget Randy's point that the notice must be given before the policy is issued. Don't forget the employee must be informed of the maximum amount of coverage, again, before the policy is issued. Don't forget the employee must be informed the employer can keep the policy after you retire. Now, I cannot stress this too much. The rules we've just talked about cover key employee insurance. They cover life insurance that's used to fund a stock redemption. They cover life insurance used to finance a death benefit only, a survivor's income benefit plan. They cover life insurance used to finance non-qualified deferred comp. In other words, these rules cover every possible situation, no matter how large the employer, how small the employer, or no matter what the employer is doing or how legitimate it is, what the employer is going to do with the life insurance proceeds. So be very, very careful here. And as Randy has pointed out, or we've pointed out, any kind of change, even in a contract which was purchased before August 17, 2006, any kind of change is going to be considered or could be considered a material increase. Certainly a material increase in the death benefit is going to be a material change, but we don't know what else will be. So be very, very careful. Now, one more point, one last point, and that is these rules are capped off by what's known as related party rules. And related party rules vastly extend the risk of all these transactions because, as Randy's pointed out, parties may be considered an employer who you'd never consider an employer. And so you've really got to read the rules. And more importantly, if you have any question whatsoever as to whether somebody is or is not an employer, my advice is treat them as if they were. Go for your notice and consent. Get those papers in your hand before the contract is issued and make copies and give them to the insurance company and give them to the attorney and give them to the client. But get those papers done, the notice and consent, and assume that you do have until an attorney for the client says that you don't have an employer-employee relationship. In other words, assume every situation that could possibly be construed as employer-employee relationship, assume it is, and go for the worst.
Well, yeah, these are some scary rules.
These are very, very dangerous and scary rules. Hopefully they The IRS will back off a little bit from them because they went overboard in doing what had to be done. They went way overboard, in my opinion, with these related party rules, and they need to back off a little bit. Hopefully they will. Well, that pretty much wraps up our discussion of insurable interest, and the bottom line is we come right back to where we started three sessions ago, and that is, what's insurable interest all about? It's designed to prevent gambling on human life. It's designed to prevent the reduction of human life into an economic commodity. It's designed to prevent attempts to use life insurance to speculate on life and, of course, to prevent people from killing someone else. And so what we look for in insurable interest each and every time is, does the owner of the policy have more to gain by the insured's living than dying? And does he have a lot to lose if the insured were to die? Those are the things you look at case after case, and every case will be looked at both by the insurance company and by the courts individually.
Steve, I think that these last three calls on insurable interest have been great because this is an area that there just isn't a lot of information on, and people overlooked for a lot of years. But I'm going to go out on a limb right here, and I'm going to predict that this isn't the last time you and I are going to talk about insurable interest this year, because there are a lot of lawsuits pending out there all over the place in a lot of different parts of the country over the issue of insurable interest, specifically in the context of investor-initiated life insurance. And before the year's out, I have a feeling that we're going to learn some more about insurable interest. I think it's going to be an interesting year.